2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 331, Reflections on Who Owns a People's History, the Controversy Over the Leonard Arrington Collection. A panel discussion featuring John P. Hatch, Stan Larson, and Dean L. May.
He is here. He's the preeminent Jacksonian historian. He's going to speak on Joseph Smith because he's authored a biography. He asked me when I picked him up from the airport, how did you end up working for Sunstone, and I just said, well, I needed a job. Well, the story is that I used to work for Deseret Book as the assistant manager at their Cottonwood store, and when all this was going on, not thinking, as I often do when I speak too quickly, I sat down at my computer and I fired off a nasty letter to the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, and I immediately, before it was even published, regretted the tone. That's something I still work on, just to calm down and breathe and take it easy a little bit. But I regretted it because of the tone, not because of the consequences that followed. It was published Saturday, and Monday I went into work at Deseret Book and was fired on the spot. I went in, there was someone, there was my manager, there was a regional manager, and there was someone from Human Resources. And it was not a meeting designed to let me explain myself or say, oh, this is what happened. They had my final check printed. They took my keys. They escorted me out of the building, and it took 5 minutes. And so we thought it'd be fun if I moderated this panel. Well, given that history, you might find it a little bit odd. I honestly do not. The focus of my letter, I should say, was the unfortunate way that it ended up making Leonard look. I regard Leonard Arrington as a hero. I only got to meet him a couple of times before he passed away, but he embodies for me the faithful Latter-day Saint who can write good, honest history. And so I was very upset by the fact that it appeared, I know the church wasn't saying this, but it appeared like Leonard was dishonest, his integrity was in question, and that's really what the focus of my letter was about. But my purpose on the panel today is actually to defend, I don't know if the right word is defend, but to perhaps explain some of the church's motives. We really felt like we needed to have some sort of a balance on this, and despite my history with this, I think I can do it because I believe what I'm going to say. I wouldn't get up here and say something that I didn't think was true. I do have to do a brief editorial and say, people asked me after I was fired, were you called in for disciplinary action or to see your bishop or anything? I was called in to see my bishop, and I want to make it absolutely clear, and I will say this till the day I die, it was a wonderful, wonderful meeting. He was not there to check me out. He was not there to check up on me. The love that I felt from him, the sincerity that I felt, he just wanted to know if everything was okay. And I told him it was, and he did. He didn't criticize the church. He didn't criticize me. He just made sure that everything was okay. And I think it's important that we tell those kinds of stories alongside the other unfortunate ones that do exist, and I think we need to tell those as well. What we did was we called actually a couple of archivists at the church that we know, and we got some talking points. And these were things that I felt were very pertinent to this discussion. Hopefully the way it will go, I will offer some of these things. Stan, I think, is going to speak more directly to the actual Arrington affair. And then I think Dean will talk on whatever he'd like, but I think he'll talk on larger issues of archives, the responsibilities that historians have, the responsibilities that archives have, and that sort of thing. One thing that I have noticed that happened during the Arrington affair that I would like to point out, this was not a talking point from the church, and something that happens a lot is, and as I pointed out yesterday in my question in Levina's session, that we tend to assume that those we disagree with have dubious motives. And so if the church wants this collection back, or if the church wants it for some reason, then it just must be to hide it. It must be for something bad. They wouldn't want it back if it wasn't for something bad. And I just quickly wrote something that says, if we do not want the church or its leaders to assume that we have dubious motives when we write honest history, then we cannot and should not assume that the church has dubious motives in the way it runs its archives. I simply cannot take it when historians, Mormon historians, regardless of what their motives really may be, are questioned. Of course everyone has biases, everyone has those sorts of things. It's impossible to be totally objective. We hear this drumbeat a lot from people who have been critical of people like Michael Quinn and other historians, and everyone knows that. But it seems for some people to think it's impossible for someone's agenda to be to write good history and to write honest history. And because I am so opposed and so bothered by that attitude that we would attack historians if we don't like what they write and just say, well, it was obvious that they had bad motives, we should probably extend the same courtesy to the church and assume that perhaps they don't have bad motives. And I will make it clear at the end that I don't think the church is without blame in this, and I think Stan will talk more about that, but I do want to make that clear, that I think we perhaps need it must be a two-way street, I suppose, and we need to respect that. The other thing that I thought I would point out is that it seems that everybody in the church wants to believe that there are magical, mystical, amazing things in the church archives. Now, to use Richard Pohl's metaphors, the iron rod saint seems to want to believe that the iron rod is in the church archives. When we were in Tucson, Richard Turley was very gracious. We were sitting around the hot tub out in Tucson for MHA, and he came with his family, and we just barraged him with questions, and he was very gracious to answer them, even though we were probably driving him crazy. And he said the number one question he gets asked is the sword of Laban in the church archives? And the number one question, and he assured us that it was not. But the iron rodders seem to want to believe that, whereas the other side wants to believe that there are all sorts of secret documents in the church archives that's going to shake the foundations of the church. It's going to shake or the foundations of whatever you don't like in the church. Again, there's sort of that two-way street that if we point and laugh at people when they say, you know, I think the gold plates are in the church archives, perhaps we should point that finger at ourselves when we say there's a document in there that will prove that Joseph Smith didn't translate the Book of Mormon. He wrote it, and we'll find it one of these days, and we'll show people. Other things to consider, and these are some of the things that one is mine, and these are some of the talking points that we got from the church, and I really do think they are good points. They don't explain everything that happened in the Arrington Collection controversy, but I think they're things that we need to keep in mind if we are going to have a balanced discussion. First, there are ownership issues with archives. I think most historians realize that, but perhaps we see, oh, archives, these are history. Everybody just ought to have access to everything. Why don't we just all freely share? And an experience that I had, and Stan can perhaps comment on this, I'm doing some research at the University of Utah on a particular individual. I'm naive. I'm an undergraduate. I went up and wanted his diaries copied because it's so much easier to transcribe them at home than to go up there and do it on a laptop. And I was told that I couldn't have copies of those diaries, of course, and I mean, apparently everybody but me knows this, because they need to keep their collection unique. And that was the explanation that I was given. And I think considering that, and what that translates to me, and again, he is more than welcome to clarify if I'm incorrect, but what that translates to me is if everybody and their dog has a copy of these journals, then all of a sudden it's not very important that they're up at the University of Utah archives. And I think that same consideration should be given to the church. If we get upset that they want documents that they think are theirs back, and I should say, I disagree with them, but when we talk to these people in the archives, they really believe that President Hinckley gave away the farm. They strongly believe that they had a legal claim to these documents. I completely disagree, but again, I suppose that goes back to motives. But I think we need to keep in mind that collections at archives are very valuable. There is ownership issues. I know several rare book dealers, they sell very, very expensive things to archives all the time because they're trying to keep and maintain these collections, and so it's important to them to maintain those. The second issue is one of confidentiality, and again, I do not suggest that this is an entire excuse for what happened, but something that I think is a real moral dilemma is something like the minutes of the Quorum of the Twelve meetings. Because what a great source for historians. I mean, these are the people that run the church, and we can see what they're talking about, and we can see what's going on. There's another side to that, and that is that if leaders of any institution can't meet and believe that it will be confidential, they can't do their business. It's just that simple. If the brethren meet and are afraid that 5 years, 10 years from now, again, everybody and his uncle is going to be looking at what they say, they can't speak in confidence. They can't say what's on their mind and what needs to be said to do the business. And that goes for any institution. And I think, again, that is a point that I'd hope we'd keep in mind. Again, I hope people realize this is not meant to excuse every behavior out there, but this I've found that things are rarely a black and white issue. And I hope we keep that in mind. Also, when we're dealing with the brethren, these are people who have perhaps a longer view than some would, in the sense that as people who obviously believe in an afterlife and that sort of thing, I think that if you ask them, they would be just as disturbed if you read what they said 5 days from now as 200 years from now. And I think, again, that is perhaps... So we may say, well, that's ridiculous. You know, if it's available 100 years from now, what do you care? You're dead. They would care. I really think that. The third thing, and this was something that the church, that a church archivist gave us, and that has to do with the way things are donated. This doesn't directly, I think, affect... affect the Arrington thing, but I, again, for a larger discussion about archives, I do think it's important, and that is donations. Of course, ever since the Mark Hoffman era, the church does not buy documents anymore. You can imagine why. They have to be donated, and this individual we spoke to at the church said, if anybody says that everything ought to be open, they've never sat in someone's living room and had to deal with these people when they're trying to donate their papers. They really want, he pointed out, I have no idea where it's at, but they really wanted a World War II collection of papers and letters. And I guess it was just great, just a lot of good stuff about the church, about the war. And this woman would not donate them because she was so embarrassed at her husband's spelling. And that's the sort of thing I think archivists face. And Stan probably knows that much better than I could ever explain. But she was so concerned with his handwriting and that sort of thing. That she did not want to donate. That spelling, imagine letters that talk about extramarital affairs, family abuse, just anything that people might want to be kept in the closet, especially in a religion, in a religious community, and in a culture that just says, be normal, be conformist, be like this, and look good, and don't talk about your problems, basically. That's a little bit more negative than I want to sound, but you know, people don't air their dirty laundry in Mormonism. And so I think there's that consideration. Fourth, and this is mine, any person who is a serious historian who has worked in LDS archives, I'll talk about someone who said this, actually, this is not mine, but said that any serious historian who works in LDS archives knows the professionalism of the team there. That was said by Will Bagley. Now, that's someone who, if you've read his book, he is not always praising of the church. Or those that run the archives. But Will, in a talk at Ken Sanders at a signing, said, the church archives gets a lot more flack than they deserve. The people there are very professional. And for a book on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, he said, I was given almost everything I wanted to see. There are very few exceptions when he could not see something. I think that says volumes about the church. And I think personally, I'm ashamed to say that I haven't given them that slack when perhaps they've deserved it and just assume that they're trying to hide everything, and I don't think that is true. And the last couple of things that I think I would say, first is that, and I suppose this goes a little bit off of what Armin said yesterday in Levina's session, change does occur in the church. It really does. It just, I think for most of us and for people like me, it doesn't occur fast enough. And it doesn't occur, you know, as soon as we necessarily want it. And I think that is true in the way Mormon history is handled. There was, of course, the awful setbacks of after Leonard and his team were basically dismissed from the church archives. And again, that's why I wrote that letter. You know, I think I made some comment about how the church treated him like garbage in life, and now they're treating him like garbage in death. And because of after they'd kicked him out, you know, I can't imagine why they'd be upset, but. The church does change, and the example in the way it views its history, and I just encourage us to be patient, myself especially. An example would be Juanita Brooks. She wrote that book about Mountain Meadows in 1950, and when it came out, well, the church officially was silent, but the two or three apostles that made comments, Joseph Fielding Smith, who I understand never read it, said, just awful. It's just awful. And LeGrand Richards, I think it was LeGrand, met with her and spoke to her, and she said, well, it's honest, it's true, and he said, well, great, you shouldn't have done it, basically. You shouldn't have done it. And they did not like it. I think most of us know the story. She was practically ostracized, I believe. Her and her husband never really had a church calling after that, never spoke in church or anything. 25 years later, and it's a long time, I'm 25 years old. I mean, 25 years later, her book's in Deseret Bookstore. She's doing signings there. And her book is, and we'll see if Bagley's replaces it or if it's just alongside the shelf. But for 50 years, her book has been the book on Mountain Meadows Massacre. And it is not that kind to Brigham Young. It is not that kind to other church leaders at the time. And as a former employee of Deseret Book, it was a perennial seller. Although it didn't sell as many copies, we regarded it sort of like McConkie's Mormon Doctrine in the sense you've always got to have copies because there's always going to be somebody that comes in and wants to buy it. The church does change in its history outlook. Another Deseret Book publication, Encyclopedia of the Latter-day Saint History, certainly apologetic, but it had an entry on magic. Wasn't done by Quinn, maybe the next edition will be, but it acknowledged that the Smith family practiced magic. It acknowledged that Joseph Smith dug for buried treasure. Again, it was very apologetic in tone and in content, but it moves along, perhaps just not as fast as we would like it to. The last thing I'd like to say before I turn the time over to Stan, perhaps I should just read this. These are, I suppose, the things that I'd like to say. And again, I say I don't want to suggest that LDS Archives is perfect or there is certainly not room for criticism. That's why we're here, and I hope we can have some critical comments. I still firmly believe that most of the documents in archives need to be available, and too many are not. And I think that's a shame, and I think that the church in both the short and the long run would benefit from releasing those. Personally, perhaps not nearly as much as many of you, but I have read a lot of church history, a lot of the new Mormon history. I have never read anything that said to me, that made me think, I don't want to be a Mormon anymore. But quite frankly, when I hear apostles saying he wrote that article to embarrass the church, when I hear them covering up the history or sanitizing it, that's when I think, maybe I don't want to do this anymore. That's what troubles me, is when we try and hide the history and when we're not honest about it. What's in the history doesn't trouble me at all. And so I really hope that the church can improve on that and that the archives can improve. And I hope that the church will learn to deal more openly and honestly with its history. What I mean by that is a lot of people complained when the Brigham Young Manual came out. It didn't talk about polygamy. It wasn't, it was certainly sanitized. I didn't care. I mean, I didn't expect anything like that in a church manual. People don't go to church for history lessons. People don't go to church to hear about polygamy. That doesn't bother me at all. But what does bother me is when historians who privately research, privately publish, their own books and their own works, their temple recommends are confiscated, and they are, blacklisted, basically. I hope that will not continue in the church. I as a young person, I feel like I got on the scene too late. All this stuff I'm talking about is long over with. The Newell speaking ban, the September 6th, these sorts of things. I hope that those things don't continue in the church. I really, truly do not. But I hope we can be mature. I hope we can be humble enough to realize that those people over there on 50 East North Temple are not perhaps as evil as we make them out to be. I hope we remember that while we have this discussion. And with that, we'll turn the time over to Stan to review what happened with the Leonard Arrington controversy. Thank you.
Yes, there's a lot of change, and the church is changing, but how much is the same? I'm going to have to begin a little bit differently when you talk about being fired on the spot at Deseret Book for writing a letter to the editor. I know what that's like. I had worked for the church for 11 years in the church translation department. Six of those years, actually, in another country, in England, working on a doctorate that's supposed to take 3 years, but because I was working full-time and trying to go to school full-time, and yes, I had a family of wife, I think, yes, I had a wife, didn't see her much, and five kids, it was hard, it was very difficult. But I came back and again had continued my job at the church, but during the time that we were over in England, I worked on New Testament textual criticism, nothing to do with LDS history or Utah history. It turned out that between finishing the degree and selling our home before we could come, there was about 6 months. So I decided during that time to reacquaint myself with my wife and kids, which was kind of nice. We got to see a lot of places in England. But I also had some spare time to think about what I had learned in biblical studies and textual criticism of the New Testament with some things that I had, of course, learned very much about the Book of Mormon. And so I did draft of an essay on comparing the Sermon on the Mount in the Book of Mormon, 3rd Nephi, with the Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, and looked at a comparison between the two, not simply from the King James Version that we normally read, but looking back at the history of all the Greek manuscripts and the early versions and so forth. I won't go into all the details, but I made this comparison, and had written a draft of it. It hadn't been published yet. In my conclusion was a little critical, because what I said was, didn't prove anything. I simply said, there's a lack of evidence in the Book of Mormon for anything ancient below the King James Version earlier, because there were several 10 or 12 major conceptual changes in that small three-chapter Sermon on the Mount over the Christian centuries. And so basically I said we would expect in an ancient document that was translated freshly in the 19th century to show some of these ancient things, and it didn't show that. Well, again, I had written a draft and passed it around to some friends, and then went to work the next day, and I was called in by my boss and the head of personnel, and they simply said, "Did you write this?" I said, "Yes." They didn't say it was right or wrong. It just said, "We have been told that we are to, you can either go through a tribunal, or not tribunal, but some kind of a discussion, decide what to do with me, and there would be these witnesses and so forth." And I said, "Well, is there any chance that it's not really fair if my bishop doesn't like, because it was way over his head, he doesn't like it. What if I get a different bishop?" He said, "Well, if you get a different bishop, then we'll just get a different group to take care of it." Anyway, the point was, I was told that I had a choice. And I said, "Well, how long do I have to think about it? Can I have a couple weeks?" He said, "We want to know by tomorrow morning." So I was told that if I resigned, I would get 1 month's pay. And so in talking to my wife that night, she said, "Well, it's better than having nothing. We ought to have 1 month's pay." So I know what it's like to suddenly find myself a person to need to find a different job. However, the good news, I'm really happy. I knew that someday I'd probably have difficulty as a church employee, because my ideas over the years had become more liberal, and that's okay. It turned out that all I was doing at the time was working at 7-Eleven, and so I became a manager at 7-Eleven, and then about a month and a half later, there was an opening at the University of Utah Marriott Library, and I've been there since. And so it's a wonderful experience. I love the working in archives. It's an opportunity to help people that are doing research and have research needs without making judgment calls on what their topics are, but to try to help them to attain what they're after. The one thing I wanted to also comment on, a couple times it was mentioned as the Leonard Arrington affair, and then also the Leonard controversy. I prefer the controversy. I've just come from one of the sessions about the Fanny Alger affair that Oliver Cowdery referred to, and the question is, was that a usual affair, or was it a real marriage? And so there's controversy over that. I'd rather keep this to the Leonard Arrington controversy. I appreciate that there's so many here. This is not about the Mountain Meadows Massacre. This is not about Mormon polygamy in Nauvoo. This is about a modern situation of what happens to a person's papers when they die and they're placed in an archives. And it happens to be about a very, and I'm speaking to people that know this already, but a very important individual. Leonard J. Arrington was, as you know, the first professional historian to become church historian. 1972, he lasted till 1982 in that position, and they did wonderful things. He did personally, plus he opened up the archives. It's called the Camelot era, or the Camelot decade. And at least it had that decade, and it was a wonderful time for people to have access to materials in the archives and to do research. And he was instrumental in opening that up, and wonderful things happened. it's too bad that it ended, and that's a change that occurred in 1982. And sure, let's be hopeful. I try to be optimistic, and I hope that things will open up in the future. And I hope I live so long. That would be a nice thing. If I could be guaranteed to live as long as that's going to be, that'd be a wonderful bargain. I'd be willing to enter into that kind of a thing. And I think the credit to the person was Spencer W. Kimball. President Spencer W. Kimball was the one that brought Leonard into that position as church historian. So that's a wonderful thing. Now, what about, I wanted to review a little bit about the value of his papers and of his legacy, his documents, his personal papers that were donated to USU. I guess in some of the discussions and newspaper accounts last October, November, there was a time where he was thinking of placing them at BYU, where he went after leaving his church historian. He went and they opened up what's called the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute of Church History. But I don't think that was a real consideration. He wanted them to go to USU. At the University of Utah, we tried a little to get him, but we couldn't convince him to place him at the University of Utah. We're glad that his papers went to Utah State University. And I guess there's like 658 boxes of material. That's a big collection. We deal with, on a daily, weekly basis, of collections that come to us, and sometimes they're only a little folder. Sometimes they're a box or two. But it's rare, except for political collections. When we have politicians, they have huge collections. I think our largest collection, Frank Moss, is about that size, and it's a big collection. So the Leonard J. Arrington collection at USU is 658 boxes, and there's a lot of really good and valuable material in that. Just as an example, here at Sunstone, in the last couple days, Strangite Bill Shepherd talked about using that collection to find out about the Hodge brothers and the murder that occurred, and they found information, or he found information in the Leonard Arrington collection. And then just yesterday, Stan Kimball talked about his experiences at the church archives during this period, where he was actually given an office right in there to work and do research. And it was a little bit humorous, but he said he got to see some things in that it's not going to be available today, and that's the Brigham Young distillery records. And he found out that the Kimball family had their fair share, but added the little note that this is, of course, medicinal purposes. And that's important, and it was advertised in the Deseret News during that time. For medicinal purposes, you can do a lot of stuff. I know for my Starbucks coffee, I think I'll have a drink right now. Actually, we go to Starbucks to get the recycled coffee grinds, which is very nice on the garden. So, anyway, we could go on, and you probably even know cases if you've been up to see his collection of the value of his papers. I guess it was appraised in terms of monetary value as $100,000, and that's a lot of money, but there's a lot of really good material in there. Now, what happened is that Leonard, as you know, passed away in February of 1999, and it was last year in October 2001, in which the collection of papers was officially opened. I had the opportunity to actually be there that day. I think it was the 11th of October up at Logan, and it was a wonderful ceremony, opening the papers and talking about his life and the value of his work and that era of that decade where so much important work was done and materials and documents were available that aren't always, unfortunately, available today. And I guess, and then, so that was a wonderful thing. I guess to me, the saddest part was the fact that that day, his widow, Harriet, had been in a, that morning, had been in a car accident. Not too serious, but she wasn't actually able to attend, and so I didn't get a chance to see her then. But the Merritt Library is almost like my home sometimes, but I call home and call to my wife and say, well, let's see, I'm coming from this home to your home in a few minutes. Anyway, it was a nice opportunity, and then what happened is that because it was then open, it was available and open, there were a delegation of church employees that were sent up to look through, I guess, several first, and then finally a group of eight that went through day after day, looking through everything in every folder of every box and making lists. Not asking to make copies or to do anything with them, but simply noting what was in the collection. And then they went back to church headquarters, and I guess they compiled I have it printed out from the internet and the site where all the list of materials that were then officially requested by the church from the Leonard Arrington collection. And part of the request, I mean, it was simply saying that these were materials that the church owned and that Leonard Arrington supposedly shouldn't have and that were to be returned. And so it was a huge amount of material. The list of the material is about 6 pages long of all the different documents that they were saying should come back. Many of them had been published, but these were, and none of these, another thing to make clear, some people aren't always aware of this, that what Leonard had, and I'm glad to be able to say the present tense, has in his collection now are not originals. These are copies of the original or typescripts from the original. So in this kind of work, it's always better to go to the original, but if the original is unavailable, then you have to work with what you can get. And sometimes a typescript is all you have. It's obviously a little better to look at a photocopy of an original, because then you're, at least second generation, you're looking at the thing through the photocopy machine, and sometimes you need to actually look at an original document. There are times where, for example, at the Merritt Library, that we, for preservation purposes, in an old document, we will make, and often this occurs at the time of the donation, where the family, we are able to talk them into giving us the original, but it's a hard thing to convince people to give up great-grandpa or great-grandma's diaries. We like to get women's diaries, and they're not as numerous as men's, but we want to do that. But it's hard to do this, and so part of our strategy is to say, well, we'll make a copy. So often we'll point out that we don't just make a copy, we'll make at that time two copies. One will go to the family, and the other will then be kind of the patron use copy, so the original can be kept back and safe from wear and tear, and would be available if someone, every so often, they'll be looking at it and say, well, I can see what it says, but I'd like to see what's underneath the scribbled part. And that's sometimes important to note. And so sometimes looking at the original, you can see that. So that's in his collection, it consisted of always these copies, typescripts of the material that was being requested back. And it was a huge list of material. So the next stage was that Utah State University, receiving this request from the church, temporarily sequestered those documents and the boxes with that material so that was no longer available for a period of time. Now at the time when this occurred, and it was almost daily, you'd see new things in the newspaper about what was happening or not happening or who was saying what and so forth and so on. We wondered, and I even had conversations with my level of person in the manuscripts at USU, and he said, we have no idea how long this is going to take, and so we were hoping it would be a short time, but it was just, that was the way it was set up until they could resolve this. And what happened, the next stage that happened was kind of interesting, in that it wasn't just between USU and the church, but there was to be a kind of a arbitration committee of eight people. And I thought at the beginning, I mean, there was four on each side, that, well, how's that going to help? You got these two sides, and now you've got a group of four from each side. Well, each side's going to take their own point of view, and you need an odd number. You need to say there's either five people or there's seven people or something like that. They had eight, and so it didn't quite seem. And then this group, and so there was, let's see, I guess two general authorities from the Quorum of the 70 who also had connections with USU as students, had been students there, and then Rick Turley and the church lawyer. Of course, Rick himself is a lawyer, but he's also head of the historical department and the family history and the whatever the new combined name is for those. So that was the church side. And then the other side was the provost and Ross Peterson as a historian at USU, and the lawyer for the Arrington family, and then also a lawyer for USU. So those were the two sides. And that what was presented, they would talk about this and try to work out something, and then they wouldn't actually decide anything. They would then present what they thought should happen to Kermit Hall, president of USU, and Gordon B. Hinckley, president of the LDS Church. And so it didn't seem like, I mean, how could that work? You got two sides, you got equal number, so it's fair on both sides, and they're going to make a decision, and they're going to go to the presidents of these two institutions. But in the meantime, while all this is happening, and this only occurred, it was finally resolved that the following month, by the end of November, there was a public relations nightmare of the worst sort when this began to, you know, people just couldn't let it go, and for good reason. And so, in spite of the fact that in the church news, and actually the statement was in both, that they referred to their case as an ironclad case. And this was both in the Tribune and the Deseret News. And the interesting thing is that in looking back over this again, there was one detail that was given in the Deseret News account about this committee. And it was that right now, folks, this is the Deseret News speaking, the people on this committee, the eight, four from each side, will not discuss what is happening until a decision is made. Now, that wasn't mentioned in the Tribune. The Deseret News had that information added, sort of like, well, just hold on, folks, it'll be okay, and we'll let you know later. Well, the decision was then made later in November, but the unfortunate thing, and that's why there's so few of us here today, that no one is able to talk about it, because I don't know for sure that they really signed anything. It was just an agreement that they were not to talk about it. So, from the church's point of view and from USU, there's no one that can discuss what was happening there. But in spite of the fact the Deseret News said, until this is decided, then we'll let you know. Well, we don't know what's happened. But the good news is, I think that actually the very good news is that what actually occurred, what was the decision at the end, instead of being hundreds of, remember there's 658 boxes, and there were several hundred boxes of material or parts of boxes. Some estimates were that it was 60% of the whole collection. It's hard. You look at them, and it's all the different numbers involved. But what was actually given back to the church? And actually, I should correct that, because technically, the church wasn't given anything by USU. What happened is that the lawyer for the family, who was on USU's side, remember, the one of the four, made a request of USU that they return certain things to the family, which USU did, and then they were promptly given to the church. So it wasn't given to the church, it was given back to the family who gave it to the church. But it consisted of one half box. Now, a Hollinger box, an archival box, is 6 inches wide. So this is a half box, which is about 3 inches wide. So it's not a lot of material, certainly compared to the 658 boxes. This is one half box that went back. But what did it consist of? And what was the essence? See, they talk about giving away the farm and what they'd ask for an awful lot. What did they finally get back? In other words, we have to do this. We have to kind of say, well, what happened in these negotiations? Well, there must have been something that from the church's side was not negotiable. We have to get back certain things. And there were. It was on a certain topic. And it consisted of three parts, we're told, and this is both in the Deseret News and the Tribune consistently say this, that there were three things given back, and it altogether was one half box. It was Heber C. Kimball's diaries and a thing called the Book of Anointings, and both of those. Now, Heber C. Kimball, his diary that was during 1845 and early 1846 wasn't just a normal diary. It was actually what was happening at the time in the Nauvoo Temple that we now have again. In terms of the anointings and the ceremonies that were occurring during that period of time. That was in the Heber C. Kimball diary. And then the Book of Anointings, interestingly enough, the day that the entry for Heber C. Kimball stops, the next day is this next document, which is called the Book of Anointings. And so it's really a continuation. They've gone to a new document. It's not Heber C. Kimball's diary. It's the Book of Anointings. And then the third category of things that were returned and the wording was the smattering of minutes of the Quorum of the Twelve meetings, which Leonard Arrington had prepared in response to an official assignment by the brethren on a certain topic. They never tell us what the topic is, so we don't know. And unless someone can maybe in the discussion knows what this is. So there's those three things. Now, that half box, that was a major success for USU and a dismal failure for the church, who had asked for all this stuff. And in fact, part of their ironclad case, when the mention of ironclad was in relationship to two documents that Leonard Arrington decided. I'll talk about the more recent first, which is in 1989 he had signed a document that the transcripts of the Edith Romney, there's a 45 volumes of transcripts of documents that Edith Romney had made, that these were to be returned to the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute. And that document and the awareness of it occurred way before this episode we're talking about, a couple years earlier when the stuff had first gone to USU. And the USU had given it back to Joseph Fielding Smith Institute down at BYU. It turns out that's, even though they got it back, there wasn't much glory in that win, because there was, for some reason, we don't know how it happened, but an extra copy scattered of most, if not all, of those 45 volumes elsewhere in the Leonard Arrington collection. Now, the other document was a 1980. Now, remember, he was church historian, from 1972 to 82. So this is while he is church historian, signed on the historical department letterhead, that he would return the documents that he had and had been lent back to the church, either before when he retired, or if he died, or conditions like that, that he would get these back. Now, the USU's lawyer said, well, we're not sure what that refers to, because we assume that was all taken care of. And so the end result was this one half box of material that was given back. So in summation, and I mention this because not many people are aware of it, but certainly true, one of the main, and this just occurred this morning, it was news to me. It's not news. It's good news that someone said that one of the most faith promoting things and institutions that he has worked with is signature books of minutes of a certain meeting in the Quorum of the Twelve that took place in 1902. This was published a few years ago when we were able to identify that's actually what it was. It was found, believe it or not, in an apostle's diary. Now, you have to think of the fact that there was a period of time at the late 19th century where people keeping diaries, it used to be you just had to write them out, either with pencil or pen or whatever you were using. But with the typewriter coming in our case, it was Rutger Clausen. In his diary, he mentions in his handwritten diary that his father, Hiram B. Clausen, had given him this typewriter. And so he was, you know, this was a few months earlier, and he said he was practicing on this typewriter. And then suddenly, what Rutger Clausen did, as others did too during that during a later period, and even today, it's either a typewriter or rather a computer that you keep your diaries on. He actually had longer paper and began typing his diaries. So at a certain point, and never goes back to handwriting them, it's always typing them. And it happens, to cut a long story short, that in a certain point, and he has, I was going to say rarely do you get to see the Quorum of the Twelve, but actually very likely other members of the Quorum of the Twelve of the turn of the century, of the turn of the 20th century, get it right here, we're not sure what they're doing now, but I'm sure they're keeping diaries, but they go right back to the church archives. Anyway, back to Rutger Clausen, who was keeping this diary. He had minutes of the Quorum of the Twelve, and a lot of them were keeping that in very great detail. There was a certain section in which it exactly was four pages, and it was blue. It was typewritten, but instead of like his normal black ribbon typewriter, it was suddenly blue. So we had it analyzed, and we found out that, in fact, it was showed evidence of a carbon copy, a typewritten copy. And so that was, and then there's a lot of circumstantial evidence to show that what we had was a carbon copy of the official minutes of the Quorum of the Twelve for that day, that Rutger Clausen was actually the one that had kept them because the other person had been sick, and he had been assigned pro tem to be the secretary for the Quorum on that day's meeting. So the meetings of the Quorum of the Twelve are very few and far between, but you'll find them scattered in different collections. And in this particular case, in that one half box, there was this part that went back to the church archives. That's my survey of what happened, and what I'm hoping is that we'll be able to discuss some other questions that you have in detail in our question and answer period, but I'll turn the time over to Dean now.
I feel I'm kind of a curious person to be addressing these issues. I teach at the University of Utah, and hence I'm not privy to the decisions that are made by administrators at Utah State or at the church archives. But I'm glad to be here. I want to tell you about an experience I had. Some of you may not know that I worked with Leonard Arrington in the history division of the church historical department from December of 1973 until September of 1977. And it was a very rich and rewarding time and a wonderful time in lots of ways. A time that some have referred to as Camelot, a phrase that I'm not particularly fond of because I'm fun-challenged, and somehow a Broadway show seems to lighten the whole episode more than I would prefer it be. I call it the Arrington Spring, and of course that's a takeoff from the famed Dubček Spring or the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia. It was a bliss in those days to be alive and to be part of the excitement of people coming in and learning and exchanging ideas and sharing. It was truly a wonderful time. During that time, I was doing some work for Leonard, and I happened to be going through some of his papers, and I found a letter that had been written to him from President Benson's office years and years before, when Leonard had published an article called Zion's Board of Trade, A Third United Order. And I've told some of you this story before. The letter from President Benson began, "Dear Brother Arrington," Errington. And I've wondered ever since whether he had a bad stenographer or a better sense of humor than I had thought. But I do remember very clearly an artifact that Jeff Johnston, who is here today and was then working for the archives of the church, had of older time and a different time at the church archives. It was a bronze door sign that said, that was from the church historical department or what was then called the historian's office, that said, "Library, do not enter." And from the perspective of the academic historian, I always saw that as sort of a symbol of the Dark Ages, and with the Errington Spring, all was changed, and we wouldn't expect to see that kind of sign again. But I think I was a little bit naive in failing to understand and to empathize with the task of the archivist who and the librarian, who are commissioned by their institutions, whatever institution may commission them, to do a very important threefold task. One, the acquisition of materials relating to the mission of the institution involved. Two, the preservation of those materials. And, of course, preservation includes cataloging them so that they can be found when needed. And connected to that, the task of facilitating the utilization of those records. So I see, and archivists probably know, I know they know a lot more about this than I do, but I see their task as threefold: to acquire, to preserve, and to facilitate the use of. And I think that the institution that creates that body of material certainly has the right to say certain portions of this archive are, for reasons that we feel are justifiable, should for reasons that we feel are justifiable, be kept inaccessible to a broader inquiring public. And I think I don't know of an archive where that doesn't happen and where that isn't a normal part of archival operations. When I worked at the Franklin Roosevelt Library in the Henry Morgenthau diaries, I would just about get to what was clearly something really juicy that Henry Morgenthau had said about Mariner Eccles, and then there was a sleeve over that page, and I was not allowed to see that. I still don't know the reasons, but I'm sure that the archivists who placed that sleeve there felt that they were probably being responsive to the wishes of the Morgenthau family, and there was probably some period of time during which portions of the Morgenthau records would be closed in order to protect the feelings of people who might be hurt by what was there. So I think archivists have that responsibility as well. And yet, as a historian, of course, I want it all. When I go into an archive and there's something I can't get and I can't get right away, I feel very hurt and I feel like, wow, what are they trying to hide? Why aren't they making these materials available to me? So I'm saying basically that archivists and historians have a symbiotic relationship in that the archivists make the work of historians possible. It couldn't be done without the archivists. But at the same time, the archivists have a need to preserve and protect the materials that they collect, and historians have a bias in favor of maximum openness because they want to look into every nook and cranny in order to find out what it is that they're researching, what it is they're trying to understand about the past. Okay, with that thought in mind, now I want to move to another little metaphor. A few years ago, when I was doing the video series, People's History of Utah, we went out to Merkur. Merkur is a place, about 50 or 60 miles west of Salt Lake City, where there were gold mines in the late 19th and early 20th century. And then when I went out to Merkur, they were opening the Merkur mine again. A Canadian company called the Barrick Mining Company had noted that the price of gold had gone up sufficiently that it was actually worth their time to go back through those old diggings and even some of those old tailings. And they had several Euclid trucks, great big huge trucks, drag lines working all day, 24 hours a day, digging into a mountain that had been honeycombed with miners' tunnels prior many, many years ago. Sometimes they'd come across old wheelbarrows and buckets and stuff in there. And they would take all that material, they would grind it into face powder consistency, working for a whole week, leach it with cyanide. And they were kind enough to let me be there on the day once a week when they did a pour. Now, to do a pour, of course, is to pour out the molten gold from all of that burden of soil and materials that they had gone through during the week. And that day they had 5 ingots, 200 ounces each, that came pouring out as molten metal and quickly hardened and were beautiful to look upon. They were elegant and wonderful. But I couldn't help think of those 5 ingots that were not much bigger than a brick that you'd use building a house, each of them, and we could easily place on this corner of this table, and the mountain of material that they had removed and ground to face powder consistency during the previous 7 days in order to get those 5 little gold ingots. Now, that whole experience has been for me since that time a metaphor of what historians and other researchers do. When we go into the archives, we go through mountains and mountains and mountains of material to try to understand the episodes that we're trying that we're searching for enlightenment on about people in past time. And at the end of the day, it seems to me if we are responsible and careful in our research and lucky, we may have these 5 little gold ingots that are put into our writing and communicated to others as our understanding of what was in that whole mountain of material that we went through. But of course, we don't just grind that mountain of material into face powder consistency and put it in a landfill somewhere. We keep those materials thinking we might be searching for something else in that body of ore someday, and that it would be good to have them on hand. And sometimes, and I guess it's the nature of historians to do that, to never throw anything away. Gee, we have a constant hassle in our house because we'll never throw anything away. And frequently I do find riches that I have saved, and more frequently I find stuff that I have saved that I didn't know I had, that somehow I put in that garage full of my research materials. All of this is by way of saying that my understanding of what happened with the Leonard J. Arrington episode is that that he left those 600 and some boxes, what was the number, 658 boxes, the mountain of material that he'd gone through in a lifetime of research and writing about the Latter-day Saint past. And during that lifetime, he himself could easily have forgotten which material was attached to which kind of promise, which material was attached to which kind of agreement, and so forth. But I don't think that mattered so much because, and again, I'm speaking as a historian, and I understand an archivist and a lawyer might see this very differently. But my feeling is that when you approach an archive and take notes on materials in that archive that relate to your research interests and the topic that you're pursuing, or even make photocopies of materials at that archive, that you are, in essence, creating a mini-archive that is shaped by your intellect and by your mind and by your understanding of what is appropriate to gather together, what ores are necessary in order to get the gold that you're looking for. And in that process, then, according to my labor theory of value, you make those materials in a very real sense your own, and have a right then to dispose of those materials in whatever way you may wish when the proper time of disposing for those materials comes. And so, as I argued in a little letter I wrote to the Salt Lake Tribune relating to the Arrington affair, it was my feeling that, yes, there were materials there that may have particular sensitivities and that people of goodwill sitting down together would be able to identify where those sensitivities were, and that it was my guess that they were only a tiny part of the whole collection, and that people of goodwill would be able to see the sensitivities and dispose of that tiny part of the collection in a way that was appropriate and would honor the sensitivities that were there, but that the bulk of the collection had been Leonard Darrington's by the intellectual task of his working through those archives, gathering those materials throughout a lifetime of research, and by golly, he had a right to leave it to Utah State, and it should stay intact at Utah State as the Leonard Arrington Collection. So that was my argument, and that's what I have to say today. Thanks for being here.
thanks to both of these two. Those excellent comments. Appreciate both of them. We do have 20, 25 minutes for comments, questions. I'm going to repeat them back into the microphone unless you'd like to come up. Encourage you to keep them short, but certainly feel free to say what you'd like to say. Yes? Question is, has there been anything else comparable to this at another university, another state, another institution? And we'll turn the time over to these two to see if they know.
I'm sure there is, but I'm not acquainted with it. This is, in terms of LDS history, this is certainly unique, but I'm sure that there's other questions.
I'm not referring to LDS history. I'm referring to any historian's personal papers given to any university. Has there ever been a fight like this before?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I can't give you a specific, but this sort of thing happens all the time. Whenever a significant body of archived material is transferred to another institution, frequently when that happens, there is a contestation over who actually owns the original materials, who has the right to the original materials, and there is a whole body of law that has been developed to try to deal with those issues. So it's a common occurrence. It's not at all uncommon.
One other thing that's kind of related to this is that in the, let's just say, the Leonard Arrington collection, when he donated it to USU, and he donated it by a deed of gift, and in that deed of gift he gave not only property rights but the copyright to the university or the institution there. That doesn't mean that everything that he donated he had the copyright of. We have this with a lot of collections. I heard this by hearsay about Leonard Arrington, that he felt a little disturbed that in the University of Utah's Fawn M. Brody collection, there are letters from Leonard to her she owned the letter because he sent it to her, but he owned the copyright of what was said, and yet people had access to it in her collection. So you have to remember there's two aspects to everything. It's who owns the object or the document, and who owns what's written on that. So both aspects are important.
There's two backgrounds to this question. One is I have a long association with Leonard Arrington. I took a class from him at USU wherein he called me obstreperous, and he was right. My father wrote him early in the 50s, encouraging him to tell the truth in Great Basin Kingdom. My father endowed a chair at BYU. Only if Leonard Arrington came down and occupied it. And later I negotiated with Leonard the writing of the biography of my father and did some editing on the minutia. The second background, and I have great affection and even love for Leonard. The second background is that I had heard from a reputable source that Leonard knew that there was going to be a problem when he donated the papers with the church. The question is to these folks here, and it's a painful question to say and for you to hear and for them to answer. Dean may have already answered it a little. Did Leonard honor his implicit or explicit contracts and agreements with the church in the things that were included in his papers?
My name is Hardy Radd.
I'll quickly say one thing and then pass it on. I do think without a doubt Leonard honored his contracts with the church and in every possible way. That's not to say necessarily that he maybe made a mistake and included some papers in what was donated to USU that perhaps were not his. But the idea that he would have done that purposely, I think, is simply not true. And again, remember what Stan pointed out that I thought was such an excellent point and cannot be overemphasized. These were copies, in some cases copies of copies, and these were typescripts. We're not talking about an original document signed by Brigham Young or Joseph Smith. These are copies, and as he pointed out, it does get a little complicated with copyright issues and ownership issues. But I just can't imagine that Leonard would not honor those contracts. And if, in the long shot, and I doubt it, but in the long shot that he didn't, he certainly didn't know that he was doing anything wrong.
Ditto.
Well, I have to qualify that just a little bit. Leonard realized that institutions have certain rules and ways of protecting themselves and procedures of operation. Leonard was a fairly anti-institutional person in lots of ways. I don't think it's impossible that Leonard at some point said, well, we did agree on this, but I think that was unreasonable for them to expect us to agree on this in this kind of way, so therefore I'm going to put it over in this box, and maybe they won't find it, and it'll be available to researchers someday. I really think it's possible that Leonard might have done that. And I'm speaking as one who honors and loves Leonard and his name and his legacy as much as anybody I know. Yeah, so I think that there's that slight qualification, is that Leonard, as a sort of anti-institutional person, sometimes felt that institutions have rules that are obstructing what the main purpose of the game is, which is to understand the human past in all its dimensions, and therefore, in some particular instances, may have, quote that word, may have deliberately put materials that he hoped would become part of his collection at USU and be available to all researchers that he knew might not have been available at their original venue. I really think that's possible.
Let me add one other thing about material that, say, the Marriott Library at the University of Utah has copies of things that are at the originals are at the church. We have a number of things, like, just as one example, is in the Scott Kenny. Worked years and years during that period in the 70s on a forthcoming biography of Joseph F. Smith. And there's a number of things where he didn't just take notes or type in transcripts, but he actually got photocopies. And there are some of these, not all, but some, in which there's a stamp from the church archives that in the Scott Kenny collection of material that they own. Now, what we do is we honor that they're owning it, and so for that thing in the Scott Kenny collection that has the stamp of the church archives, people can see it, they can look at it, they can read it, they can take notes, they can even type it if they want to, but we won't make copies of that document because the church has that. The other thing, and this is interesting, it was at BYU several years ago from Rick Turley, and I remember it distinctly. I was thinking of certain things, and Rick Turley was talking about ownership and this same distinction of ownership of the property rights of a certain diary and ownership of the copyright to the words written on that diary. And there's an awful lot of stuff that the church has that they own property rights to, but they don't have the copyright to. And one of the things he said, as he made that distinction, is that they owned, a particular diary, and even though they didn't own the copyright to the words on that diary, it was usually, depends on all the legal formalities of estates and where it passes on to, but if they weren't given a deed of gift for the copyright by the person himself, then it probably went to descendants and family members. But he said because they owned that diary, they could, if they want to, burn it, destroy it, do whatever they want, even though they would also be destroying the words and the copyright to those words that other people, descendants, had. So again, there's that distinction. You have to always keep in mind of those two aspects.
Other questions? Levina. Let me repeat that really quickly. Levina asked, at the University of Utah, Stan made an example of Davis Bitten's diaries. He asked that they be returned to him, and they were, with the original string still around them. And this was in the newspaper, and Levina makes a good point. Leonard's diaries are supposed to be sealed until 2010, I believe. And at the church, it has been reported that they were opened and read by at least one person and apparently passed around, and Stan can comment on that.
Yeah, I'll comment on the Davis Bitten part too, which represents what we what we've done in the past with a certain collection. I remember when I first, well, not immediately when I went there, but within a few months of joining the staff at the Marriott Library, that I was taken over and, you know, shown these boxes that had strings around them that was kind of intriguing. And this was Davis Bitten, and I knew who Davis Bitten was. And the condition was that those diaries that he had given to us were not to be opened until his death. And that wasn't just for patrons, but for the staff. I mean, that's why the strings were around him. And we joked about it, like, should we open it up and look? We wanted to, but no one did. And I don't know what the condition was, or what the reason for the condition was from Davis Bitten, but we respected that. And then more recently, he came in and said he wanted them back so that he could do his autobiography. And so he actually has all of his collection. It's a little side note, but I'm in the process of asking him right now for a letter or some little thing he wrote, just so we can get his collection with at least one folder, anticipating for it to come back. But the point was about that condition by the donor of what the collection was. And, of course, we respected that. And no one opened it up or looked at it. It wasn't available for patrons to use. Now, that's rare. In fact, in his case, remember one thing about the University of Utah, to correct a little bit of what you said, all archives are there to preserve the material. Now, what we do is we preserve it and we get it ready for people to use. Now, there are other institutions, and they have the right to do this. They will preserve it and not make it available except for, oh, yes, I'll let you look at it, but not others. What we have at the University of Utah is not only for everyone, but there has to be built into the donation a time at which it will be available. So sometimes that's X number of years from now, or sometimes it's when the person passes away, or sometimes it's, like in Leonard's case, 25 years after he passed away. And so we need to have that. And so in this case, now we'll switch over to the answer specifically of Leonard Arrington. The original diaries are at USU, but he gave a full microfilm of his whole set of diaries to the church archives with a condition that it not be read or used or opened or perused or whatever for 25 years. It's actually 2023 that it's available. And I guess... Very good. I was just getting... The next thing about that wasn't... It was not only this contract, but there was a little box that said that if you wanted to tick this box, then it would be available for the people in the archives. And he said no, it was available to no one. And so that's the problem. And I think it's a real problem that... Remember this group of eight people, one of which was Rick Turley, one in that conversations that we're not privy to, but we do know that somehow in the discussion he made them aware that, well, he'd actually seen the diaries, and then he pointed out that, in fact, yes, well, we did go in and look at things. They read it, or he had someone do it, prepare typescripts, at least a part, and then circulated that to the general authorities. Now, that's a no-no. That's a major no-no, and I don't know how they can do that. I mean, we had in the sense that the intellectual desire to see Davis Bitten's. And it was more than just curiosity. I mean, there was an interest there. But we didn't do anything, and yet in this case, that has been compromised, and for reasons that maybe these are higher authorities, but that's not how we do it at the University of Utah.
I have to say really quickly, too, that after having heard that, if Dean was correct and Leonard purposely did place stuff in his collection in the hope other people would see it, then good for him. If people are going to read his diaries. Yes, question.
I wonder if Dan could speak about how archives take collections and arrange and describe them, and why you thought they would be reluctant to get rid of, you know, 400 boxes, that with the amount of manpower invested and the money, and also if the Arrington family donated the collections, if there was any money given to Utah State to process it, and if the church, if they got those boxes back, would be willing to compensate Utah State for all the money.
First of all, I don't know anything about any money that was given. Sometimes we do get collections with some money to...
What's the question?
What was your question?
And you could just explain how you thought they would be reluctant to give up a large collection after processing the amount of money and manpower they spent.
Okay, so in essence, that's as an archives, when you receive a collection, wouldn't you be happy to give away some? Well, actually, no. When we get collections, say at the University of Utah, or in this case at USU, you get the collection and there's an integrity about the whole collection that was gathered by that individual. You've touched on that a little bit, Dean, and that this is very important. It shows the research interests of that individual. And one of the things also is that you often get in collections, you get books. And as long as what we do is with those books, then we make a list of what books came in the collection so someone can see what it is. But what we don't just send the books off. We actually look through, at least thumb through, each of the books to see if, and this often happens, you look at and you see annotations by that person commenting on this long since dead individual who wrote the book, commenting to them about what they have said in their book. And so what that becomes to us, and most archives, is part of the manuscript collection. So if Leonard had some comments in books, then those should stay right in the collection. And so we want to keep things as they come. The only exception, understandable, I think, is that if we get, say he did an article and it's been reprinted and we have 50 copies, we keep one. We don't keep the other 49. Those could go and go to book sales or give to other libraries or things like that. Now, so that's what happens. We want to keep the collections as an integral unit for the person whose collection it is, but also to have research purposes to be able to say, this is what was gathered by this individual at this time.
Leonard one time told me that he went down to the basement and found all these unexamined manuscripts of Brigham Young and from the early days come across the Pioneer. And I'm just wondering whether you know about any of that material, whether that was in his collection, whether and how much of that may have been processed, assuming that story is true. The other specific question, too, is about a very rare document, which supposedly is a 250-page document in which a grant commented on these beds about the foot of King's Cross and a count of 50. I'm just wondering about those kinds of very rare documents, supposedly that are in the church archives, but
let me try and summarize. The first was the point that Leonard had said, and I believe this is correct, that he found, I believe when Leonard, in his autobiography, he talked about going to the basement of the church archives, or you mentioned the temple, he went somewhere, and he found Brigham Young's papers. And if I'm not mistaken, I mean, I think they were in the original boxes that they did in like the 19th century. They had never been gone through, they had never been cataloged or anything like that, and Leonard worked on that. I'll pass the mic, but I know that the church has actually gotten better. They're slowly opening up a lot of Brigham Young's papers, and that was a lot of that, I think, was what Stan mentioned as the Edith Romney typescript. A lot of that was for Leonard's research on Brigham Young, American Moses. The second question was about a rare document, and I'm sorry, can you clarify a little bit? Okay, so a document, 250 pages approximately, about the Kingdom of God, the Council of 50, and that sort of thing. And I'll let these two comment on that and the first question.
Well, one thing that is actually very good news, as we said earlier, is that the Leonard Arrington Collection at USU is intact and available, except for that one half box, most of which is available elsewhere. And so you or anyone else can go to USU and look through that whole collection. Now, the additional good news is that on the Internet, under Utah State University, and looking into Leonard Arrington, you can actually get a listing, a register or an inventory of what's in all those boxes. And so you can see. And so when you go up, you're not just going blind, but you'll be able to say, I want to see something in Series 5 box 10, folder 3. You can get that specific. So we have that facility. I don't know the exact answer, but if it is Ian Leonard's papers, then it's available up at USU. If it's still at the church, then best wishes on success going to the church archive.
I hate for sessions like this to become exercises in hearsay, but what I was told was that at the time that they were moving the historical records of the church from the old church office building, now the church administration building, to the new church office building, that they came across a large set of materials in boxes that had been apparently in those boxes since the move south in 1857, and that there was a rich body of documents there, but certainly by no means the whole of the Brigham Young papers or the whole of the Brigham Young collection. And that may be what you're referring to there. As for the political kingdom of God, I don't remember Leonard ever mentioning anything to me about that, so I don't know about that.
They were just cataloged and are now part of the general collection of the church archives.
Yeah, those papers are at the church archives, yes.
What position does an archivist and a historian take about the idea that people don't die?
It's
people, 25 years from now, or David Benton's collection, when he dies, or something, you know, the church is taking the position that they're not dead, they're still alive.
And he's right. The point was made, and he's correct. I believe Dallin H. Oakes has pointed out, well, the church keeps things secret private at the archives because we believe in life after death, and therefore, you know, we have to respect that in the next life. And I won't tell you what my opinion is, but I'll pass it on.
Now, Ron, isn't the reorganized church policies, is it 75 years or 50 years? That's even better news. The Community of Christ, formerly known as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, has a policy for their general authorities, apostles, first presidency, that 50 years after, I guess, if there's a council meeting minutes, it's 50 years after that occurs that it's then available for scholars to look at. Now, I had the temerity in one of my little articles near the end, in fact, it was probably this one about the Council of the Twelve minutes, to suggest that the church consider that. I haven't heard any positive response, but that's what I think should be, so that there is a legitimate thing about confidentiality and during the lifetime of an individual. But when you know that all the people have passed on that it's talking about, I think that there's more of a reason to be able to say, well, let's look back at that and be able to understand this document and others in a better context.
My guess is that in the Rocky Saint tradition, Rocky Mountain Saint tradition, there is a greater sensitivity to, strangely enough, to lineages, families, kin, family kin connections. And so I think there is a sense that even though somebody died 200 years ago, that 100 years ago, that they might have descendants who are still sensitive about issues that might be part of their collection. And probably there's an unusual and in most cases unnecessary, in some cases necessary perhaps, sensitivity that relates, I'm not saying this very well, but that has to do with clan self-understandings, and that the church is sensitive to them in a way that many institutions would not and don't have to be. I think that's probably true. I'd like to say one more thing, too. I've had the benefit during my career of dozens and dozens of archives who have worked so hard and so industriously and gone the extra mile to make materials available to me that I otherwise wouldn't have known about or wouldn't have known how to find. And that's happened at the church archives and at the Roosevelt Library and at lots of places, at the Oregon State Archives and at other places. I am deeply impressed that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints expends each year huge amounts of money to make available a pleasant reading room where facilities are available, archivists who are experts and specialists who know their collection and are happy to help you in any way they can. And I have found my research far and away much more facilitated and encouraged by people at the church archives than ever discouraged. And I think most people who have worked there, as the quote from Will Bagley said, have had that experience. This is a private institution. It doesn't have a public obligation in the way that the University of Utah does. But in spite of that, this private institution does make materials available, does have their archives mostly open, and is very generous in making those materials available to researchers.
That's absolutely correct. Another point, two points that I'd quickly make, and we're running a little over. It's lunchtime, though. We can take one or two more questions if you'd like. But one point would be that at the church archives, my understanding is you don't go and see a diary, someone's diary, and the whole thing is restricted. They'll photocopy certain pages. They'll photocopy around pages. If one page, for example, has been restricted for whatever reason, a lot of times it focuses on the temple. Another point that Dean made that I have to echo is families are very protective. You can imagine the John D. Lee family today is very, you know, sensitive and protective about his name. And it's amazing how people can become. George Albert Smith's children, and I'm not sure which family members, but they delayed a publication of a family biography called Builders of the Kingdom for over 20 years because they were not comfortable with some of the things that the author Merleau Pusey had written. And so it wasn't published until 1981, and he'd written it long before that. Any other questions? Yes. The point was made, and I'll pass the microphone down, that this big clash seemed to be nothing more than a clash of archival egos, and that it was a big to-do about nothing. I will say that I think it was very unfortunate how it became so public, and I'm not sure why it was, and it seemed, for a church that is usually very tight-lipped about its actions, seemed very strange that Sorensen had written a letter to the Tribune, and the church was being very public about it, and that caught me off guard. But we'll... Oh, sure.
I know it involved a little conjecture, but why was it handled so abrasively? The way it was represented was that, like, lawyers just came knocking at the door, and did nobody anticipate this would be a huge public relations? Yeah.
Right, and so that next point is, why was this handled so poorly? Didn't anybody anticipate that it would be a public relations disaster? The newspaper even got involved. The Tribune is writing things like, people from the church descended upon USU and things like that, but I'll let these two comment, and then we'll break for lunch.
That's where what we need is some individual from the church archives to hear to tell what happened, because it certainly didn't work out very well. But there was an important principle here, and that is that when an individual gathers, some of it created, but some gathered their collection and then donates it to an institution, that institution, the integrity of the collection should stay as that individual had given it. And with maybe some, there might, in this case, there was a very small amount of negotiated material that ended up as one half box. It was a public relations fiasco. And why? I don't know.